Since ChatGPT dropped in late 2022, AI has barely left the news cycle. Left, right, and center, generative AI and chatbots are practically all we hear about. AI will steal our jobs, we are told, but at the same time also save the world.
To help us sort fact from fiction, myth from reality, we are joined by Associate Professor of Political Economy of Communications at the University of Sydney, Dr. Benedetta Bravini. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Will, for having me.
Could you give us a very brief overview of what generative AI actually is?
Absolutely. And Will, as we are speaking on a very difficult day for Australia, I just wanted to briefly acknowledge the profound loss and the suffering that has been caused by the Bondi attacks and extend my condolences to the families and the loved ones. And so we are in a privileged position of being able this morning to discuss generative AI. And the first thing, right, I would say is that it's really not a form of an arcane magic. But it's really the procedure of training a model, right, with input data. And so if we take a closer look at the methodology and the terminology, in especially coming from my discipline or sociology or computer science, we always think of generative as something that is defined as being able to produce or create something. And so by applying this to AI, in general, every model, you know, could be technically considered as generative AI. But I'm sure that what you're interested in is really a definition that has been popularized, right, of generative AI. And when we use it in popularized accounts, so over the media, for example, we need to think in terms of the AI systems that use often, most of the time, machine learning, and particularly large language models, so text, and they are basically predicting the new word or a token based on context, right? Obviously, I could go on forever to give you examples, but when we think of the broad category of generative AI, we think of AI systems that generate new content. But very often, we use it to refer to applications like ChatGPT, like Claude, like Gemini, that are the very common ones that everybody had been playing with. And so, and these are more specifically really applications of large language models that basically are learning, you know, and understanding patterns. And so they really predict the next token just based on the statistical patterns. And I'll stop here and I'm happy to go more in detail.
And Doctor, what is the digital sublime? I'm interested to know. And how does it apply to AI?
I think digital sublime is an incredibly important definition because when we thought of sublime, for example, in art, in history, in philosophy, we always thought of something that almost overwhelms us. So it was a concept developed, if you think of Immanuel Kant, for example, like the idea of the sublime, is something that is provoked in you by things that are huge, that are very powerful. And so this idea of digital sublime is something that is very important, for example, in my discipline. Mm. And it's been applied to the technological age by a lot of philosophers. I'm for example, referred to a very famous Canadian thinker called like Vincent Moscow. And like in his studies, he really saw how this digital sublime translates into this idea that this technological age is coming to rescue us. So it's coming to rescue us from the climate crisis, for the crisis of job losses, for the crisis of capitalism, for example. And so we see these patterns being replicated again and again. Like Will just started by saying that obviously Gen AI is something that can save us or can doom us, right? And so this is specifically where the digital sublime becomes so relevant.
Yeah, Professor, sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to talk to that point that you just said there. There's such a narrative about the omnipotence of AI, both in terms of it being able to save or destroy the world. Do you think these narratives are perhaps damaging or not true?
Well, you know, these narratives are really mythologies. And what mythologies do traditionally to us is like they are framing the debate in a way that we stop imagining other different worlds, right? So if we're told, don't worry about the climate emergency, we'll find a technological solution, we'll use an AI solution, then we stop looking at the damages and the social, economic constructions that are at the basis of the crisis, right? So we're just waiting on a sort of a magic wand that will save us.
So perhaps we're putting too much trust into AI.
Absolutely. Like, the thing is that a lot of these definitions of AI are actually referring to something that is not even currently present, right? We talk often, for example, of AGI, artificial general intelligence. You know, this like incredible superior form of AI systems that could actually even outperform humans. But these forms of and applications don't really exist. But they're very important in creating this narrative of the savior, you know, technology as the savior. And this is really not the first time. And if we think of the history of AI, you know, we have developed AI since decades, but now it's been popularized precisely because of the take up of these major language models. So it is important to be aware of these mythologies that are present and also to be deconstructing these mythologies and say, okay, so what is it that is actually available? So like a lot of these technologies that is available are actually machine learning models that have been around for many decades. So there are nothing so incredibly surprising and so incredibly new. So, and this is very important because the mythologies of the sublime are often making us think that this is coming for us in a future that almost seems always evolving, right? So we're talking about something in the present, but it's very connected to the future. And this is precisely how mythologies work. They always work in a similar vein to religion. And very often we replace religion with this type of mythology.
And what can we as ordinary people do about these risks associated with AI? And how do we sort of avoid falling into traps of using AI for maybe the wrong thing?
I think actually, it's what would be really crucial, and it's important also for us when we write or we discuss this and we have this conversation in the media, is to acknowledge the things that we already know. So what we know is, for example, that global data center electricity consumption is on the rise. We know, for example, that there is a major water and energy problem with developing and pushing data centers, for example. And so if we start with what we know, then we also we can also have a conversation about what to do, right? So
yeah.
Because the major category of AI is so vast that we will need another, 2 hours to actually define what AI really means. So we start with knowing that when we interact with ChatGPT, we consume something like half a liter of water, right? And this type of understanding that I called green AI literacy really helps also the public to feel more connected and to be able to make choices. Like, we have to decide, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what's happening at the moment in Texas, for example, where the governor has proposed to the citizens, well, maybe you should shower less so we can power our data center.
Yeah,
so what
wow.
is important is to be able to decide on these trade-offs. Do we want to have water or do we want to transform my resume into a poem? Sometimes it's really a matter of trade-offs, but we have to start with literacy because a lot of these conversations are not yet in the public domain. And I think it would be very important to have the public more involved. So what you're doing today is very important.
Absolutely. This is all really interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Bravini, for taking the time to chat to us this morning about the reality of AI.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.